for an artist with 1,000 fans to have the same business infrastructure as Taylor Swift? Oh, yeah! That gets me fired up! That's a beautiful world.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum the colorblind ideology builds?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibilities?
What's up, tightrope community? Welcome to today's episode. So if you walked up to me on the street and you asked me, what is the tightrope podcast all about? I was thinking, here are the things I would say. First off, it's a conversational space. But it's not just any conversational space. We don't pre-plan it all out with fixed positions. More importantly, it's a conversational space built on two key principles, love and justice. That doesn't mean we're always in agreement, doesn't mean we don't disagree with others, doesn't mean that we don't tell hard truths, but the love and justice stand at the heart of what we're trying to do. We also love to lift people up and to have a good time, because Cornel West is actually one of the funniest people I've ever met, truly a funny person. But we always tell the truth as we see it. Now, we're not saying we have a corner of the market on all truth, but we tell the truth as we see it, and we're willing to defend it. So that means sometimes we take some risks, and that's why it's partly called the tightrope, because you can lose your balance if the truths you're trying to tell are not all that popular. But the most important thing I think we try to do on this podcast is to help each other and hopefully help you survive this troubled world that's been created, and give everybody the tools to reimagine it. I'm Trisha Rose, and I'm certain there would not be any kind of tightrope were it not for Dr. Cornel West, my dear co-host, very good friend, and one of the greatest intellectuals on the planet. Cornel, how are you doing today?
My dear sister, it's always a blessing to be in conversation and dialogue with you on the tightrope. We might not always be breakdancing on it, but we're moving. We're making sure that we are in motion on the tightrope headed toward truth, love, justice, and beauty. We believe the arts, music, painting, architecture, indispensable, staying on that tightrope.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Even when you fall off, right, you want to figure out how to do it with a little bit of style.
That's right.
You want to hit the deck.
You could be in rhythm as Newton's law of gravity is dictating your fall.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Hit the ground, get back up, straighten your jacket.
That's exactly.
So, Cornel, what's been this week? I mean, there's always so much to think about, but, you know, if you could share your perspective on any one thing that you think has been on your mind a little bit. You know, people are so enriched by your insights and your perspective. You don't have to cover everything, but just something that's been striking you right now that we'd love to hear.
Well, you know, I think in these moments of such overwhelming grimness and bleakness, that it's good to go straight to the most fundamental challenge and questions that we could ever raise. And that has to do with whether we as a species have a underdeveloped capacity to treat each other right in such a way that we can preserve the species, or whether in fact we're headed toward destruction because we haven't cultivated the capacity to allow us to avoid destruction. I'm thinking about the ecological catastrophe. I'm thinking about nuclear catastrophe. I'm thinking about, who knows? We don't know what 3 weeks would be from now. I was just at a press conference the other day calling for international observers for the U.S. election. We may be in a situation where we call for U.N. troops to help mediate conflict between American citizens. You know, the troops from Congo coming to New York City to make sure we Americans don't crush each other. We're at that point now. We may need some international or external help in order to make sure that our democratic process can proceed. But in the midst of such grimness and bleakness, when we look at that head on, we've got to realize that we do have the sources and resources to get through it. That's what fortitude is. Not just courage, but courage with a spiritual and moral dimension gives us a direction in light of a grand vision. That's fortitude. And we do have the fortitude, I think, to make it. It's just a matter of trying to exemplify it and gather up all the energies and spirits and intellects and visions and bodies and communities and traditions that we can to do it.
Right, right. So do you think fortitude requires a spiritual frame, or is it just somebody who can just grind it out, stay on point, stay on habit? Or do you think that there's a spiritual underpinning to that capacity regardless?
I want to ask you that question. I'd love to hear what you say. But a lot of it depends on what we mean by morality and what we mean by spirituality. If by morality, we mean integrity, honesty, decency, courage, and generosity toward others, service to the weak and vulnerable. And then by spirituality, we mean the use of imagination and empathy to authorize a better reality than the nightmarish reality in which we find ourselves.
Right.
See, that's free of dogma. That's free of doctrine. That can even be free of particular religious traditions. A lot of times religious traditions get in the way. They trump, well, I guess can't use that word no more. They make it difficult
for people
to love. They make it difficult for folk to imagine and use their imagination to conceive of a better reality. But
right.
When we define it in that first sense, I think it is a matter of morality and spirituality.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. I agree wholeheartedly. That kind of fortitude to withstand the kinds of pressures and the phrase that African-Americans often use, keep your eye on the prize, that capacity requires that you're thinking of something beyond yourself, that you're trying to give, whether it's to your students, to your children, to the people in the world, or whether it's just sharing your art. But that broader context is part of the thing you're describing that drives people, and as a kind of a spiritual component, even if it's not, formally, explicitly so.
Absolutely. And beyond yourself, in a sense, it's beyond your tribe, your group, your race, your nation, your sexual orientation, your binary and non-binary identity. It's broader than all of those things, and it's luring you, it's pulling you, trying to accent better angels of one's nature.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of the things we're going to have to talk about when we have more time is this question of, seeing both where people are, the categories that they may choose to define themselves, but really always searching for the things that we might all share, or more of us share than not, the kind of, the tension between those two things, right? Because I really find that I'm much better in my ability to connect with people who I would otherwise have very little to say to, when I can remember that at the core, they're just as afraid, just as hungry, just as tired, just as hopeful sometimes, just as despairing as I am. And they've added categories I can't get my head around after that. There's another layer. I'm like, what is going on? But I do better when I stay at that core level, at least imagining the possibility,
Absolutely. For me, it's a matter of just knowing that somebody loves them and they're trying to love somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's a way of keeping track of their humanity. It's very rare that people just go through life and have absolutely no desire whatsoever to connect in a meaningful way with somebody else, or to actually find joy in being loved or being affirmed and recognized and acknowledged.
Yeah.
So that at that love level, there's a deep human connection. And I would say it also relates to dogs and cats and some other sentient beings who bring such meaning to our lives.
Oh, that's so true. I'm glad you said that, because, we'll talk about my dog, Billy, when we got more time.
Oh, Billy.
Yeah, Billy Holiday. And but we left the holiday off. We just went, kept to Billy during the day.
But it's a girl dog, though.
Yes, it was. Yep. She's not here anymore, but she taught me almost as much as Andre about love. For real.
Billy died, though?
Yeah, well, Once I got her and I realized I did the math that I was, unless something terrible happened, she was going to die first. I spent her whole life preparing for that. Yes, she died a few years ago. She was 12.
So that was 84 in U.S., well, I mean, in human years. I shouldn't be so anthropocentric like that, though. But
she was, in human years, she, yeah, I guess she'd be about that, yep.
About 84. No, but didn't yeah. She lived a good life, though.
Yeah, she did. She did. I'm going to tell you all about her later. But the thing that you also, I think, were getting at, too, was that creativity that transcends all those categories. You started with the role of beauty in the arts. And, you know, this is very important about how do we connect across spaces to hear each other's art but learn about each other's creativity. It's so ironic. We're in a world with so much connective tissue, and yet we get so much top-down advertising about some people's art and so many other people we simply have no way of hearing about. That really connects to our guest today.
Oh, who's, yes.
Who's created a space for creators to be in communication with each other and with fans and that really want to hear what they're doing. So let me introduce him briefly, and then I'm going to turn it over to you, Cornell. So we're thrilled to have Jack Conte with us. Jack, it's fantastic you're here. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really honored to be on the show.
Well, we're thrilled to have you. Let me tell a few people in case some of our Tightrope Pod folks are sleeping on Patreon. Let me give them a little insight. Jack Conte is a musician, a filmmaker, and half of the group Pamplemousse, and a co-founder at Patreon, a membership platform that makes it easy for creators to earn salaries directly from their biggest fans. Patreon was founded in 2013 and is home to over 200,000 creators of all types who've earned $2 billion from over 6 million active patrons. But the money isn't the big news, in my opinion. I mean, I know that's not a, you know, Wall Street response, but the money isn't the big news. The headline for me is Patreon's role as an industry disruptor and the ways in which Patreon allows creators to connect directly with fans and their audiences, effectively sidestepping the music and culture industry, which allows creators more freedom, independence, and sustainability. Before Patreon took off, Jack spent his days in a converted dog kennel, and maybe that's why we've had to talk about Billy for a brief moment, turned recording studio. I've never heard of a dog kennel turning into a recording studio. And he was making music and YouTube videos, and many of them have amassed over 120 million views. But now Jack is full-time CEO mode, Patreon headquarters in San Francisco, where the company continues to provide creative and financially sustainable platforms, sharing creativity and paying millions of dollars and bringing people together around the world. Jack, thank you so much for coming to The Tightrope.
Thank you so much again. I'm really excited for this conversation. That opener almost had me in tears. I can't wait to talk to you two. We've got so much to talk about.
Excellent.
We just want your love, insight, and intellect to flow from your heart, mind, and soul, because we know you are an artist as well as a visionary and leader when it comes to entrepreneurial activity and preserving the integrity of the creative process. We know that your beloved wife is from my hometown of Sacramento, California. Is it Sister Natalie? Is that her name?
Natalie.
Oh, tell her we said hello.
Yes, indeed. The other half of Pamplemousse.
I will tell her, yeah.
But tell us, how do you hold together on your own personal tightrope? Being such a creative artist, we got a chance to see some of your videos with all the computers moving with the funky beat. I could feel that R&B influence. We can say a bit word about that. But then at the same time, being CEO and making sure that people have access to the fruits of their labor, how do you deal with that multiple sense of calling and vocation, my brother?
You know, I haven't figured it out yet. I don't know. it's very hard. And it's I finally found a place where I can be prolific and be a creator and come out with art and music and have a voice again. For the first 4 to 5 years of the business, I hadn't figured that out, and I was heads down in operations building this system, building this company to help creative people. And I felt a little bit like, you know, the first few years, I felt like my creative, like, pilot light was starting to suffer. And it's only in the last 2 or 3 years that I've really been able to figure out some new ways to be prolific, be a creator. And so now I'm coming out with, you know, new music videos every week. And there's some teams now to kind of help us build our creative output and do mixing and engineering and mastering and all the kind of work that goes into creating music. So that's all now, you know, a big part of the process and why I'm able to kind of be, you know, both a CEO and an artist at the same time.
Have you been finding that there's been more investment in this kind of platform under COVID? I mean, how has COVID impacted the artistic community and the creators on Patreon?
Again, this is a hard thing to even talk about. Dr. West, as you mentioned, the world is grim right now for so many people. And what a tough moment to be going through for all of humanity right now. What a tough thing. And for artists, especially, you know, Live Nation canceled global touring operations. AEG canceled global touring operations. They have to, right? No more tours. So you get these artists who were looking forward to a year of touring and income generation to help them, you know, distribute their music and record their next album and pay their teams. And that whole industry is completely wiped out with no line of sight toward recovery. You know, a lot of podcasters, you know, are seeing ad revenue start to shrink because companies are experiencing recessions and going through layoffs and cutting their sales and marketing budgets. So advertisers are putting less money into the ecosystem. So any creators who are paid through advertising, you know, whether it's YouTubers or podcasters who are running, you know, mid-roll or pre-roll or whatever ad systems they're using, those creators are seeing their ad revenue tank as well. And so a lot of creators are coming to Patreon right now. A lot of creators are coming to Patreon to start building a different model, right? To start building a different way of having a relationship with their audience and being able to build a self-sustaining, you know, career of artistry, of professional artistry, and to get paid for it. And so, you know, it's a strange thing because the company is going through an incredible moment of growth right now, and I'm really grateful for that. And I know that, you know, at the same time, if the world is going through such a difficult time, and that's a weird thing to kind of think about and reconcile. But I'm glad that there is something for artists, some alternative, you know, mechanism, so that people can continue being creative even through, you know, the horror and grimness around us.
Well, that really is grim when you start cutting back on the artist like that. I mean, artists being the vanguard of the species, and the species needs all of the spiritual and moral resources and sources it can get to help mobilize the energies and vision to keep us going.
Artists show us the future. You know, show us what our values are going to look like 20, 50 years from now. Artists are ahead of the rest of us, and they paint that picture for us, and they inspire us, and they show a vision of hope, and they pull us closer. They pull us into the future, and we need them now more than ever.
I expected there to be some growth on Patreon, but it was sort of shocking to hear, to really be reminded of that massive infrastructure that has been suspended. But, you know, if we take the very top artists and put them aside for a moment, because I'm going to hope that they have at least a little savings in their bank accounts survive. But then, you know, I'm wondering, too, about, you know, the growth of smaller artists and their capacity to use Patreon, but also the ways that it might be creating opportunity, not just for audiences, but for a way of shaping their careers and how they want to communicate. So can you share a little bit about how Patreon is impacting the creative presentation and vision of artists at this moment?
Absolutely. I think it does a couple things, and you just called it out. It changes the economics of professional artistry. It changes the economics of professional artistry for an entire class of an entire generation of artists who have been trained for a decade plus that they're not enough, that 20,000 views isn't enough, 50,000 views, not enough. That's just a couple hundred bucks in ad revenue. 50,000 views, that's not, you're not a you can't be a professional artist with 50,000 views. And in my view, and in Patreon's view, 50,000, that's two basketball stadiums full of humans who are looking forward to your next thing. If you're reaching 50,000 people with your words, with your poetry, with your painting, with your art, with your videos, with your music, that's 50,000 human beings who want to hear from you and want to know what you have to say next. That's powerful. It's economically powerful. It's powerful for the soul. It's powerful for people. It's powerful for connection. And those folks ought to be able to continue making stuff, right? In what world, the way I like to think about it is like,
right.
In what world is 50,000 people not enough? In what world? And so Patreon changes the economic system so that if you have 50,000 patrons, you can be building a massive business and renting office space and investing in your creative longevity and future. So that's the first thing it does. It changes the economics of, you know, I think you mentioned like the top artists. Well, folks like to call the opposite of that. They call it the long tail, right? The long tail artists. And for a long time, the long tail has been folks who are getting 10,000 views a month or 20,000 views a month. Now there are creators on Patreon. If you're getting 10,000 patrons, 5,000 patrons, forget it. You're not the long tail. You're making a killing. You're crushing it. So that's the first thing it does. The second thing it does is it changes the relationship that artists have with their fans. Because here's how I like to think about it. I'm an artist, and one of the things that I think I've always considered, artists I think don't have a healthy relationship with money a lot of the time. I've seen artists push money away or not want to think about money or not want to deal with money or not want to, they feel embarrassed by money. They feel embarrassed about asking for more when they're negotiating for something. They push it away. And I think for artists to know what they're worth and to know that the reason they don't have that feeling of worth is just because of how this ad model has trained them, how these platforms have trained them. That when you open up your YouTube app and you see, you know, all the impact you're having, and then right below it you see your ad revenue of $85. If you've been trained on that over and over, every time you open up that YouTube app, suddenly, or not so suddenly, 5 years in, you start thinking, I guess I'm just not worth that much. Mm-hmm. But we think artists, and I believe artists, are incredibly impactful and should be treated as legitimate, viable contributors to the workforce. There are people who are generating impact and reaching millions with their work. And the key with changing the relationship with your fans is we give artists the relationship to have with their customers. So with their fans, like you get the email addresses of your fans. If you want to reach your fans, you can send them a post. And we'll send your post to all of your fans. There's no holding back. There's no algorithm that says, okay, we're only going to post to 2% of your fans or 1% of your fans. We give artists the control to reach 100% of their audience 100% of the time. That's really important. What other small business on the planet gets separated from their customers, gets separated from their fans? That's not fair. It's not fair to artists. Artists deserve, they're contributors to the workforce, they're legitimate small businesses, they're members of society that are having impact. They ought to be able to have a relationship with their customers like any other small business on the planet.
Yeah, wow.
Well, you make a strong, strong case, I must say. I was thinking of some of the great artists who just died broke the Ten Commandments financially, you know, Rembrandt selling all of his paintings at the end, Zora Neale Hurston, unmarked grave in Florida. You're absolutely right about artists having a sense of calling that oftentimes has little to do with the flow of cash in their direction. But let's look at this in a Socratic way, too. The gains of the Patreon model, which I think are immense, you just laid out a few, and I know you can go on and on. What would be some of the losses, though, brother, as an artist makes the shift from the older model that's fading to this new model? Because it seems to me every model's got certain gains and losses. As Jane has faced, it's up and down. How would you characterize the other side of it, the underside, as it were?
Yeah, so we're on the tightrope here. So let's do it.
We're on it together, so you're not gonna fall. You're not gonna fall now. Don't worry about that.
I'm gonna give you the real stuff here. I'm gonna give you the stuff from Jack as artist, not Jack as CEO. So look, I'll offer this. There's two things. First, there's something beautiful about saying what's in your heart without outside influence. Outside influence of politicians, outside influence of brands, outside influence of fans. There's something beautiful about saying what's in your heart and ignoring the world around us, right? Because often we know, we have a sense. And when you develop that strength of relationship with your fans, there's a temptation to serve your fans and to treat your fans as customers and to build for your fans and to direct and change what's in your heart. And Patreon doesn't solve that problem. Now, that problem exists with CD sales, and it exists with...
Absolutely.
As soon as you weave economics and art together, there are market forces that an artist has to be aware of as they say what's in their heart. And Patreon does not solve that problem, right? Because you get closer to your fans. Now, some artists love that. Some artists are resilient and they resist the temptation. Some artists are fine just being more
accommodating.
I think that's an important thing to be aware of as we're talking about the trade-offs of any system that we build. We have to have an honest conversation about those trade-offs.
That's right.
I think that's a real trade-off.
But you said there were two. That was one.
Okay.
Don't fool around now. He really, he's listening. I forgot. I got so into one, I forgot all about number two.
Oh, no, he's so powerful and candid and honest. He laid out that number one.
All right, I'll give you another one. And actually, I think Patreon does a good job of this, but it doesn't solve it. We do a good job. We don't solve it. It's supply and demand. There are wonderful things about that. There are difficult things about that that create problems. And if you're a super popular artist, you get paid more on Patreon. There are great things about that. There are wonderful effects that emerge from that ecosystem, and there are difficulties with that. And, you know, Patreon's system does not solve, you know, some of that disparity. And I think that's worth calling out too. Now, I'm not saying that it shouldn't exist because of that. I'm just trying to have an honest conversation.
Absolutely.
No, there's no context that's going to be perfect.
Exactly.
Even if it's all face-to-face, live performance, social structures are going to, you know, encourage people to reject certain artists because they're challenging things people may not be ready to hear. So there's always going to be, you know, a downside. But so are you imagining that Patreon basically in that way mirrors a little bit of the larger industry system? That is to say, those who get the most sales, just to use an old school model, are the ones who get the most power and the most influence and the most resources. And you're just saying that basic relationship is not fully disrupted at Patreon.
Yes, it's not fully disrupted. It is disrupted, but it's not solved. And here's what I mean by that. There's two things. The first is this quote-unquote long tail gets a lot taller and a lot longer. So more money, more power, more influence flows into what was previously considered the disempowered, right? And that's a beautiful thing. So some artists who were making $85 a month in ad revenue are now making enough money to quit their job and be full-time artists. And that is better than what it was before. Now, I'd love it if they were making even more than they're making. And we're constantly, you know, the whole team is constantly trying to help artists get paid more and more. And I guess here's a way that I like to think about it. You know, so we're all standing on the shoulders of giants, right? We're all trying to incrementally improve our systems around us. And I think Patreon is a net positive, a significantly net positive incremental improvement in the systems of flow of capital and artistry. And so, yeah, I guess I want to be honest about the trade-offs, and I deeply believe that it is a really important system to make the world of professional artistry substantially better.
That's you make a strong case, as we said before, but we really appreciate you hitting those candid questions head on in a very soulful way. You're just letting it flow. You have such a wonderful spirit about you, though, brother. Mm. I can see that Stanford education didn't snuff out any of your soulfulness, though, did it? No, I'm just kidding. You know, I'm just kidding. Let's ask a question about how is it that you got one foot in rhythm and blues, another foot in this wonderful focus, even preoccupation with machines? Man, those robots in your videos just come out at you, man. You say, oh, my God, and they're sounding good. The lips are moving. Tell us something about this dialectical tension that you wrestle with R&B in one sense, and then the machines and the robots on the other. What's going on in your worldview as an artist, my brother?
Gosh, what a cool question. You guys ask the best questions. You know, I love music, and I think I'm a very passionate person. I'm a passionate, excited person. I'm you know, generally pretty enthusiastic and positive, and I believe in humans, and I believe we're gonna make it. You know, And when it comes to music, I've found I get very analytical with music. I have to, because I listen to folks like Paul McCartney, and I listen to folks like Carole King, and I listen to folks like Stevie Wonder, and I listen to folks who are, you know, the world's greatest melodicists, and there's something that it just sounds like it comes from the heart. It sounds like it comes from not here, but here. And if I'm being totally honest, I don't know if I have that. I feel like I have to learn it, and I have to think my way into it. It's a little embarrassing for me, actually, to tell you the truth, to like admit that and to talk about it, because I would love to be one of those. I would love to be Stevie Wonder. I'd love to be one of those artists.
We'd all love to be Stevie Wonder.
but I had to, you know, I had to learn music theory, and I had to wrap my mind around melodic creation. I had to break melodies down into their component parts and understand, you know, micromotivic composition, and I had to break harmony into its pieces and understand voice leading and motion of individual melodies to create harmonies and understand the math and science of music creation. And I think that maybe it's as I was doing all that, I was engaging this very analytical, mathematical part of my brain that fell in love with other things like physics and machines and systems and robots, and I love those things, and I love thinking about them and analyzing them and understanding their component parts and breaking functions down. I love that stuff. I find joy in it, because I found so much joy in breaking music down and analyzing it and trying to figure out how I could do that too. And so maybe it's just all the same thing, if that makes sense.
A lot of sense, though.
That's interesting. That's really, really interesting.
That is fascinating. Fascinating.
So I have a question in a slightly, I mean, it's not related to of the production of the music, but I mean, I'm really fascinated with Patreon as an idea. So let me just put this question in some context. Some of the work I've done has sort of examined the role of music industry control over artistic production. You know, you have some of the most extraordinary musicians in the 20th century, jazz musicians, blues musicians, rock and roll musicians, R&B musicians, and they own nothing, right? They've created the sound that has shaped whole generations, and they can barely feed their children, their grandchildren, so on and so forth. And that level of control where they get a tiny percentage only of, you know, if they have any leverage at all, and then they, you know, can try to buy back their own music, get, you know, fight to get their own catalogs. If they're fortunate, they have to produce on the schedule of the industry. I mean, it's a brutal exploitative system. And so for me, you know, thinking about how technology can disrupt that hierarchy and allow people to get access to the fans that they want to get access to is incredibly important. But there are a couple of things that I'm wondering if you could share. I watched you talk a bit about this notion of what constitutes selling out and what doesn't. And, you know, I thought this was really interesting. So can you talk a little bit about this idea of adjusting your packaging but not your soul, you know, and how Patreon is somehow able to assist with that distinction?
Oh, yeah. So, okay, this is another great tightrope conversation. The concept of selling out is, of course, deeply divisive to the artistry community. And it's also one of those things that culture has changed around what it means over the last 15 years. And so artists have had to kind of adapt and understand as the culture of selling out and what constitutes selling out has changed as well. And so I think it's helpful in those cases when there's so much rapid change and, you know, different cultural movements to really zoom out and think about, like, what are the sort of foundational principles, the core things that will be true, you know, 10 years from now, even as the sort of things, you know, are the sort of cultural aspects around them change. And so the ultimate truth in selling out for me is I like making art. And if I can do something that helps me make more art, and if I can be compensated for that in a way that is true to my values and true to the things that I care about and matter to me, then to me that's not selling out. Selling out is giving up in a way that forces me to do something other than art creation, something against my values. And so I'll give you an example. This is a tightrope here. This is a real one.
All right, we got the safety net out for you.
All right,
we're
ready. Here we go. 10 years ago, my band Pomplamoose got paid a bunch of money to make car commercials. Hyundai paid us money to make these car commercials. Now, on the one hand, you could say Pomplamoose took money from Hyundai. They sold out. They took money from a brand. That's selling out. And then they made these commercials and put them and contributed to kind of this system of selling merchandise and contributing to consumerism and, you know, et cetera. That wasn't my view. And I'll tell you why. My view was we used that money to build a recording studio at our house. And in that recording studio, we made the next 8 years of our art and music and videos. And without that income, the band would not have been able to sustain itself and continue. And so if that's the trade-off at that moment, if it's like, this is the thing that's going to allow us to continue and sustain, and we're going to and we're going to be able to invest in our infrastructure and make more art and do the, you know, and invest in our music, I actually don't consider that to be selling out. Now, if it were a brand who stood for something and did things that were against my values,
okay, that was my next question.
But exactly.
It's Hyundai. It's Hyundai. It's an inexpensive car to help people get transportation needs met. if it were McDonald's, we've turned down McDonald's commercials. And that's what I mean by doing something that's against your values. It's at the end of the day, if you can get the income and stay true to your values and what you care about, and it allows you to invest in your art and invest in your creativity and build your studio and keep your output going, to me, that's the opposite of selling out. I wish more artists believed that about themselves and felt okay with earning money for their value and impact in the world.
I so deeply appreciate your words. I was thinking about the great funk master Charles Wright and the Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. You hear to express yourself on TV all the time. And I know that Charles and others had something else in mind when they made that song on the Chocolate Side of Los Angeles. You know what I mean? We were dancing to it under the purple lights in the garage a couple of decades ago. But at the same time, he is able to gain access to resources that allows him to continue to do his thing as the great artist and the band that they are. And they're up in age now, but they're still out there doing that thing. But when you add it, what kinds of company, what kinds of enterprises are we really talking about? I think that becomes the crucial one.
Is there, I'm curious to both of you, is there an analog in the world of academia?
Oh, yeah. Lord, yes.
Yeah.
Lord,
yes. I was already thinking, go ahead.
But I mean, you know, you always want to be careful and cautious about sellout, but there are such things, and there's sellout in any profession, in any occupation, in any job, when you sell your soul for a mess of pottage, knowing that you're violating your dignity and your sense of who you are and what you're called to do. And it has effects and consequences that leave wounds on your soul, as well as effects and consequences that might be quite deleterious for people who are suffering under various, you know, institutional structural conditions. But at the same time, we have to be honest that all of us are negotiating and navigating with terrain not of our own choosing.
Right.
And so you make certain kind of compromises. You don't want to confuse prudential compromises with just selling out. You have to make some practical judgments. But I know Sister Tricia also.
Yeah, no, those are right on the point. I mean, I was thinking about, you know, the fact that there's a lot of pressure sometimes, particularly if you're a woman or a person of color, African American, trying to speak about inequality and injustice and discrimination. You know, the rewards in the profession are not as high necessarily as if you make some other choices, unless you become a rare group of a few who transcend that. So there's sort of the rewards for fitting in, even in a profession that gives you, at least at this point in history, lifetime appointments. I mean, in some ways, we're freer because we have a kind of Patreon-type context. Nobody expects us to fill stadiums. If 50,000 people read my book, I am more than happy. I'm truly dancing on the ceiling. So
you've had more than 50,000 read Black Noise now. You got hundreds of thousands of people around the world read your classic text.
Well, I mean, come on, Cornell. That's just the beginning of them reading one of your books. But, yes, this is true. More people read it than many other books. But my point, I guess what I'm saying is that there's rewards for participating in the narrow ways that support the system of higher education. And then you get critiqued. The sellout is, you know, for what you say politically, if you stand for certain things. But then there's also the, why do you teach at an Ivy League school, for example, right? Why are you, that there's a whole narrative about why don't you teach somewhere else, as if that's the only place that is going to be truly our version of an artistic, honest engagement. People have asked Angela Davis that question. I'm like, I think she done paid her dues. She can teach wherever she wants to teach. But so we get that all the time. And so for me, what's so great about Patreon is even in the publishing industry. I mean, if I could tell you how exploitative it is in the book industry, and the way in which they take, just like you know, musicians, they take all the proceeds. You have no idea how many books you sell. There's no bookstores to even go see if they got into a bookstore or got out of a bookstore. You have no way of checking. They take all of that, and then they don't have any reason. They have no reason. It costs them nothing. You could publish yourself on Amazon, you know. When you really think about it, it's a very similar situation. Also, on Patreon, you know, you can be a poet, you know, mixed media art. You can do some, you know, you can be a dancer, you can be a painter, you can be a write a set of essays. You know, your art is not limited to these genres that have broken out. Academics are often limited, right? Unless you're a Cornell West, you can write, do whatever you want, anywhere, for any time. Most people are sociologists. They have to follow the trends in sociology. They're a historian. They need historical methodology. If they want to break down those binaries, woo, Lord, they got to explain out a book about the book that breaks it down. They got to write a book before the book. For real.
You know, part of what's happening here, and again, I think this stems from a place of optimism and belief that over the long period of time here, things are getting better. You know, I believe that. I believe over the long, humans are figuring it out. And I think part of what we're seeing right now is these leftover systems from 100 years ago, from 200 years ago, that are appendages of society now, that are broken systems from a long time ago that need to be updated and fixed. And here's an example of what I mean by that. You know, this book publisher system and that whole world. We only sort of, as a species, we only figured out how to record light onto pieces of celluloid paper 120 years ago. We only figured out how to record sound onto wax cylinders around the same time, just over 100 years ago. And when we did that, the age of commercialization, of storing art on a physical object, began. You know, prior to that, you know, you'd go to the theater, you'd listen to some musicians, you'd experience live music in person. After that, you could listen to the music after it happened. You could store the music on a physical object and then put it in a device in your home and experience the same music again. That's magical. That's only 100 years old. And as soon as that magic happened, 100 years ago, it started system after system. Trucking companies, retail, packaging, jewel case manufacturers, record labels, hundreds of billions of dollars of architecture and systems to essentially solve one problem. Take that physical object with art on it and distribute it to the people who wanted that art. And that this leftover system of book publishing is a piece of that whole architecture of moving physical objects around the world with art on them. And then about 10 or 15 years ago, digitization happened and the internet happened. And now we can be having this conversation and be connected to each other without being in the physical world. And you can make an infinite number of replicas of this conversation without any incremental cost. And the cost of digital goods has been driven essentially to zero. And none of these systems have caught up with that strange new equation. And so essentially what I think is going to happen over the next decade or two or three is all of those old systems are going to be replaced by new ones that account for an age of lack of scarcity, infinite replicability, and the digitization of art. We're at the very beginning of that as a species. The very beginning. No wonder it's such a shit show. Sorry, I don't know if I can swear, but you know what?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Like, as a species, we've only been connected to each other around the globe for a decade. There's 100 years of architecture and systems design that it needs to be reworked. It's going to take a while. Like, let's give us some time to figure it out, you know?
Brother Jack, you just kind of turned me upside down here. I usually try to keep track of the night side. I see this fascism. I see this manipulation and domination, exploitation, and the creativity and the resilience. But you're talking about the breakthroughs technologically, digitally, and so forth that could maybe bring critique to bear and open up some democratic possibilities. Is that part of your vision?
Oh my goodness. That's the core of it. Like for an artist to have the same business infrastructure, for an artist with 1,000 fans to have the same business infrastructure as Taylor Swift, oh yeah, that gets me fired up.
Yeah, I hear you.
That's a beautiful world.
Wow, so, you're going to send us all back into the studio, brother.
I'll tell you, I'm like, I better start, we better cut a record, Cornell.
That's the truth. Bring Brother Jack in with his guitar, and I get my drums together.
Definitely, definitely. I mean, you know, I think that everything you say is true insofar as these are the real possibilities that are in front of us. But there are also real dangers, not only the dangers that Cornell's mentioning, because all that immediate connectivity, especially when you're looking at, you know, extraordinarily powerful social media networks, that means they can shape consciousness. I mean, the level of sophistication of knowing human consciousness, human behavior, the biology of the mind and the soul and the spirit is terrifying. Forget this, see who likes this ad and who doesn't like it. I mean, they're at the level of fundamental biology. And then, of course, all those fascist messages that Cornell's mentioning, you know, they distribute like that, and they circulate quickly. So that's one thing. But the other thing is the subscriber model, right? Which, you know, I'm for. I've Netflix. I have more subscriptions than the next person. So I'm not suggesting I'm not part of the crowd. But a subscriber's model is part of all of this digital transition, right? So, you know, Peacock, Disney, right? Patreon, which I'm, you know, excited to join. But, you know, when you get a subscriber model, tell us how you think that avoids the kind of process of sort of setting up a terms of a relationship that are not all that different, right? I mean, I'm not talking here only about Patreon. I'm talking about the whole digital landscape and the way in which it works.
Yes. I think the world where people use currency to pay for something that they find valuable, you know, currency is a proxy for value. And a world where people use value to pay for value is a good system. Then value is value. There's an equation there. There's a dangerous system that we've used to prop up the internet over the last 20 years. And that's a system where attention equals value, where engagement equals value. And at the core of it, essentially what's happened is very cleverly, these big social media companies have figured out a way to convert, when I go like this, that equals dollars for them. That equals dollars for them. Just by getting my attention. And that world where essentially attention is a proxy for revenue, if you have financial infrastructure that optimizes for revenue, which the financial infrastructure of the world optimizes for revenue, like it or not, it's the way corporations and the stock market, and it's the way that we've set up this financial system. Then what you have is, if attention equals revenue, then you have these systems optimizing for attention because it optimizes for revenue. Mm. And that's why it's such a dangerous biological experiment on our psyches, on our souls. Because then the game is, how do we get your attention? And how do we use science to understand what you will attend to?
Extremism, violence, hypersexuality, you know, danger.
Exactly. And that is a dangerous world. And a better world is where you use currency to pay for something that you find valuable, as opposed to your attention. A lot of the drawbacks of that attention ecosystem, like privacy, like the experiment on human minds, extremist rabbit holes. You know, a lot of the sort of reckonings that humans are dealing with right now, I think are largely, a consequence of a system in which engagement is a proxy for revenue, and global financial systems are optimizing for revenue and therefore optimizing for engagement. That's happening at scale now for the over 3 billion people who are using the internet. That's scary. And when you pay for something, you're saying that is something not that I'll attend to, because there's a difference between what you will attend to and what you will pay for. There's so many things that would catch your attention, but you would never pay money for it because you don't actually value it. It makes you feel bad. It makes you feel angry. It makes you feel frustrated. It makes you lose hope in the world. I'm not going to pay for those things, but I'll look at them, right?
You almost can't not look at them.
It's very hard not to. I would never pay for that garbage. It makes my life worse. So that's why I think the system in which people pay for things that they find valuable is at a very core level. And again, take everything I'm saying with a grain of salt because I'm a CEO of a consumer payments company. So there's an important bias there that everyone who's listening should just know, right? But I do think there's a danger in that first system that we've used to prop up the internet.
Mm. Well, I think we know Tim Wu's powerful book, The Attention Merchant, that tells a story in a very subtle way of that. But it seems to me all of these models can be used for good or ill. They have great potential. I think the new model, that it's more decentralized and democratic, I tilt in that direction, which is a tilt toward Patreon, you know what I mean? But anything we human beings come up with, though, Brother Jack, I'm always a little suspicious of, because it can be used, deployed, weaponized, given the character of the people who are doing that weaponizing, you know?
Yeah.
I agree. I am I think that suspicion is so important. It doesn't feel good, and it you know, and as a person of privilege and power now, sometimes that suspicion is directed at me, and I have to like be aware of that and acknowledge that, and also acknowledge that it's good that there is suspicion. Like these, you know, it's good that we should be having these conversations and holding ourselves accountable to using the things that we make to do better.
Absolutely. And that's what artists are about anyway. I mean, you want that noble discontent. You want that Socratic energy. And even whatever your trajectory in terms of privilege or whatever it is, you grow as a human being by active listening to folk who are suspicious as they raise their voices, but you critically filter it. Doesn't mean they're necessarily right. It just means there's might be some truth in what they're saying, and they're wrong in their conclusions. But you're still trying to bring together the best as you proceed. And that's the way it ought to be, you know? That's the way it ought to be.
How do you two, I'm sure there's, I'm not sure, I know there's suspicion for universities, there's suspicion for professors, there's suspicion for, you know, any sort of entities of power. How do you folks respond to that? And how do you navigate your way through that?
Well, I mean, you know, it's, you know, I think everything Cornell just said, you know, you try to stay open to critique and learn from critique, because people help you refine your thinking, your teaching, your expression, you know, the content of what you're doing. But there's, you know, and a lot of the suspicion is based on different kind of political perceptions about where, you know, change can happen, right? Where change should happen versus where it should just be, where institutions should be entirely, you know, destroyed. So there's a sort of a political set of distinctions there that we hear and see a lot. I mean, for me, just speaking totally independently, you know, I just try to stay on what matters to me. You know, it doesn't, you know, I try to stay completely clear of, you know, who won this award, who got this foundation grant, who did this, that, or the other. Like, you know, more power to them. God bless them, you know. But am I saying what I want to say? Am I telling the truth as I understand it? Am I reaching people who say they appreciate and learn from it? And am I being challenged in a respectful way that helps me grow? And as long as all those things are going on, then everything else is all right. Whatever else happens after that is all right. You know, you can't control what people are going to do with what you said. You know, you can't control if they're going to, you know, try to take you down for it or not. You can't really control any of that. You just have to me, it's about staying true to what matters to you. I mean, there's no reason for me to be, and I remember this, I don't think I told you this story, Cornell, but, you know, when I was trying to figure out, should I go get a PhD or should I go to law school, you know, I don't come from any money whatsoever. My dad was a bus driver. My mom, you know, was a secretary. And, you know, for me, it was like, I got to make some money. I can't end up, you know, exactly where my father didn't spend all this time sacrificing for me to end up as broke as everybody else. You know, like, I've gone to Yale. I should do something with it. And, you know, one of the things that really encouraged me to be an academic was the sense that I could do two things that no other profession allowed me to do. One, I could say exactly what I thought, as long as I could get to tenure. I could say exactly what I thought whenever I wanted at any time to anybody, as long as I wasn't disrespectful and harming people. I'm talking about, you know, saying uncomfortable truth. And the second thing was I could largely control my time. And those two things mattered a whole lot to me. And there's no other profession that you can do that. And so for me, all the flaws that go on, that was very important. And it continues to be important. But you have to choose. It's someone like Cornell, who's just been a titan example for me of this truth, always saying what, even when a lot of critique comes his way, saying exactly what he believes to be true. And he's, as I would say, he's usually doggone it right, you know. And that, just that as an inspiration, I think, has been very powerful for me.
No, I'd say ditto, too. She's talking about genuine humility. She's talking about an intellectual and moral tenacity, but also finding a joy in her calling and what she's doing. And the conclusion is right where we started with the artist. Don't ask anybody's permission as to who you love, how you laugh, what your witness is. You can be wrong. You try again, fail better. But you got to be free.
Right.
And that freedom is just so important because it generates its own kinds of hope. Sometimes that hope is a consequence of your free action, your free thinking, rather than
right,
before.
Right.
Sometimes the vision is a consequence of, you don't even know what your vision is.
Mm.
You find out what it is. Get in the phone. Get in the mess. Get in the studio. Play your guitar, Brother Jack. Let Sister Natalie sing her song. And you find out what the hope is. I mean, that's not just artistic. That's the best of what it is to be human. And that cuts across race and gender and sexual orientation, national identity, and connects us with the best of our species and other species, given the prospects that we have on this planet, you know?
Mm. Oh, I love that. And I love, you know, I'm reminded of the moments, you know, the moments where I've been reminded of the importance of free thinking in company building. It's important in life. It's important. I think it's important in everything. Free thinking.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What's right for me right now, given the information I have, the context I'm in, because I'm a unique person in a unique situation. And I can read this and I can read that and there can be an article on this and that person has an opinion. But what do I think and what's right for me, given where I am? I've learned that lesson over and over again. I'm afraid I'm going to have to keep learning it over and over again. But it is such, if I had one takeaway for company building or artistry or any of that, it's the importance of free thinking, thinking for yourself. Forming
Absolutely.
Your own opinion.
Absolutely.
Yep. It's a real gift if you can cultivate it, and that independent free thinking is always done in community. I mean, it's
Absolutely.
Because it's never, it sounds individual, but it's, we're reading someone else, we're learning, we're building a company that's people, we're teaching students, they're teaching us. You know, it's about how
Absolutely.
To be a free individual thinker in community, which is an important sort of bumper system, right? To know that we're part of something bigger than ourselves all the time, you know?
Absolutely. And it's a community of the dead.
Mm.
Because there's a bigger community of the dead than there are
yes.
those of the quick, you know? And we
yes.
got so much to learn from those voices from the grave and from the dead, and the legacies, the witnesses. Sometimes they're not known as well. But we lifting every voice. That's the anthem of black people, right? Lift every voice. Mm. That means we're going back to get Sunhouse's voice.
Mm-hmm.
We're going all the way back to get the spirits. We're going all the way back to hear the Jewish brothers and sisters singing in the Warsaw Ghetto. We're going back with the Flamingo. We're going back to Rebetiko. We're going back to landless peasants. We're going back to indigenous peoples. All of those voices, past, present, and future.
Man, that just feels like I don't want to mess up this amazing climax. This is where we just drop all the lights and the mic and close down the shop and get the key and whatnot. he's about to drop the actual mic.
Oh, man, Brother Jack.
Let it go. This has been fantastic, Jack.
This has been magnificent, really.
So wonderful talking with you. To tell you the truth, I was having a tough day, and hearing the way you think about the world is just—it's so beautiful and inspiring. And thank you so much for having me. This has been such a wonderful thing for me.
Well,
we salute you and Sister Natalie, though. Both of you are a dynamic duo. I'm telling you.
Yep, for sure. And we look forward to having you another time, and we look forward to being a part of Patreon. It's an amazing platform, and we think it's the coolest thing, and we hope we can do all what we do to the best of our ability to help this world get on its feet, get healed up, and moving in the right direction.
Welcome. We are psyched to have you.
Hey, Tightrope family. This is Jeremy Berry, co-executive producer of the Tightrope podcast. Dr. West, Professor Rose, and our team are excited to inform you about a special offer coming your way. On Tuesday, November 10th, the professors will be holding an exclusive live office hours segment of the Tightrope, and you can participate. Simply visit patreon.com/thetightropepod and join our new Patreon family, where we offer a more intimate connection to the professors through offerings such as the November 10th office hours. Both new and existing patrons are eligible to join, and you'll be able to submit questions and listen in on the dialogue between Dr. West and Professor Rose. A few patrons will even get to ask their questions directly and engage in a bit of dialogue with our esteemed host. Visit patreon.com/thetightropepod to join the family. We'll post details about the offer in the coming weeks. As always, stay strong and stay on the tightrope.